Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Monday, the 2nd of December, these are our main stories. Malta's Prime Minister prepares to resign after facing intense pressure over the murder of a journalist. The United Nations Secretary General warns the world has reached a point of no return as it faces the perils of climate change. And at least 70 people killed in Syria after days of fighting between government forces and militias. Also in this podcast...
It's a mixture of ignorance and laziness. They're too ignorant to know where it goes. They're too lazy to learn. The barbarians have won.
Why a society dedicated to defending the correct use of the apostrophe is calling it quits. We start in Malta, where after another day of political turmoil and mounting pressure from protesters, Prime Minister Joseph Muscat has announced his intention to resign. In a televised address to the nation, Mr. Muscat said he's planning to hand over power once his governing Labour Party has chosen a new leader.
In the coming period, we will initiate a process so our country will have a new prime minister, a prime minister who will continue the work and the strong mandate of this government and continue to deliver the plan the Maltese population approved in June 2017.
The announcement came after thousands of demonstrators took to the streets of Valletta on Sunday, demanding Mr. Muscat's resignation. They hold him responsible for the failure to bring to justice those responsible for the murder of the campaigning journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia 2 years ago. But these Maltese protesters who wanted Mr. Muscat to step down immediately aren't happy with his plans.
I think he has the perfect poker face, and I think he's a very good liar. In that case, I guess his argument is he's a good politician. He knows how to talk to his people, he knows how to ring up his followers. He needs to resign, the sooner the better. It's a mess, it's a big mess.
I mean, the country has been declaring for a resignation to happen now. The fact that he's saying for it to happen in 2020, I don't like the fact that he's still going to be involved in the investigation. Many people don't. He has to resign now for it to be clear.
I asked our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, what's next for Joseph Muscat and Malta?
There have been rumours in the press that he was going to announce his resignation. We didn't know quite what that would involve. He met with his Labour Party MPs early on today. They had a crisis meeting at his summer residence. They gave him unanimous backing, but it seems that the backing was basically for him to decide and announce the terms of his resignation in his own way. Now, what he's done, he said he is there's going to be a new leader chosen from within his own Labour Party, and that process will start on January the 12th. Now, this obviously is not what the protesters have been asking for. They've been demanding that he step down immediately.
So, yes, it's not an immediate resignation. Will this be enough then for the protesters?
Well, Matthew Caruana Galizia, who is one of Daphne Caruana Galizia's sons, has said that protesters will be out on the streets again tomorrow. There have been a series of these demonstrations. Valletta, the capital of Malta, saw one earlier today. Thousands of people on the street carrying photos of Daphne Caruana Galizia saying that she was a national hero. They were accusing the government of being a mafia. So there's still a lot of anger out there. Now, Joseph Muscat said that he had fulfilled his promise in bringing justice for Daphne Caruana Galizia. The protesters are perhaps unlikely to see it in the same way. As things stand at the moment, we have a number of people who've been charged in connection with the case, but no one has been convicted. And obviously, there won't be any justice for Daphne Caruana Galizia until the people responsible for her killing are behind bars.
So this crisis in Malta is far from over.
My sense is that it's got a long way to run yet.
Danny Eberhard. A former Cambridge University student, Saskia Jones, has been named as the second person stabbed to death in a terror attack on London Bridge by Usman Khan on Friday. The 23-year-old, like the other victim, Jack Merritt, was at the prisoner rehabilitation conference close to London Bridge, which Khan was attending as an ex-offender. Here's our correspondent, Sarah Corker.
Saskia Jones from Warwickshire and 25-year-old Jack Merritt from Cambridgeshire were both University of Cambridge graduates involved in its Learning Together programme, which focuses on prisoner rehabilitation. Mr Merritt was the course coordinator and Miss Jones was a volunteer. The Cambridge Vice-Chancellor, Professor Stephen Toop, said everyone at the university had been left devastated by what happened.
I met Jack only once, but I must say that he impressed me as a person of tremendous charm, but also extraordinary commitment. He really believed that the work that Learning Together is doing is fundamental for the future of our society.
Saskia's family described her as a funny, kind, positive influence at the centre of many people's lives. She was intent on living life to the full, they said. The attack started at Fishmongers Hall, close to London Bridge. The venue's chief executive, Toby Williamson, described how colleagues, more used to serving coffees or working as porters, resisted or fought off the attacker, despite believing he was wearing a bomb.
This is extraordinary things happening, done by ordinary people. They used fire extinguishers, they used chairs, they used these narwhal tusks ripped off the wall in the heat of the moment, and they took the game back to the knifeman.
One of the three people injured has now been discharged and returned home. Two others remain in a stable condition in hospital.
Sarah Corker. At least 70 combatants have been killed in Syria in the past 2 days of fighting between government forces and armed militias in the last major rebel-held region of Idlib. Residents of affected villages fled north to escape the fighting, adding to the hundreds of thousands who had already moved out of the province's south since conflict there escalated earlier this year. I asked our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, for the latest.
Well, the clashes have been going on, but not in the with the intensity that we've seen in the past 2 or 3 days, when we've seen the Syrian government forces, backed by Russian air power, move in hard to try to regain territory that they've lost to the different militias that are still operating in Idlib. I mean, it's difficult to know quite how to describe. I mean, we've had this conversation before, quite how to describe the groups that are in Idlib. Do you call them rebels when they're dominated by jihadists who didn't have really as their main goal to try and remove President Assad from power in the same way that other rebels had, and they are now the dominant force. So the fighting has been going on. Civilians have died, but not to the extent that we've seen. But of course, what's been going on in Idlib, which once was, you know, in the headlines about Syria, was obscured by what was going on to the northeast with the Turkish invasion driving the Kurds out. So I think it's more that now the Syrian government's attention is turning back to this thorn in its side, essentially. President Assad has always said at one point it seemed unrealistic. Now it seems almost inevitable that he wanted to take back every inch of Syrian soil. And this is essentially what we're seeing now. And I think we're going to see it hitting the headlines again.
Sebastian Usher. George Orwell's fictional Big Brother is becoming ever more real in communist China. From now on, anyone buying a new mobile phone or SIM card must provide a scan of their face that can be used with facial recognition software. Those getting a new phone or mobile data contract are already compelled to provide their national ID card as proof of identity. But this new measure will make it easier for authorities to know exactly what you're looking at online. Jeffrey Ding is a researcher on Chinese artificial intelligence at Oxford University. He told the BBC's Julian Marshall what this means for privacy.
A lot of governments are facing this trade-off between anonymity, which brings a lot of benefits in terms of deliberative democracy, freedom of speech on the web, a more vibrant internet culture that leads to creative ideas, and the risks of anonymity on the web, which has been linked to disinformation, child pornography, terrorism. Real name identification web pushes have been implemented in countries like South Korea, Germany, France, but China seems to be willing to go a step further in terms of enforcement and just faces a much bigger problem in terms of scale when you have 850 million mobile users and an insecure government that spends more on internal security than external security.
I mean, listeners may remember the case of a man wanted by Chinese police who was picked out at a music concert attended by 50,000 people through the use of facial recognition technology. Is facial recognition becoming more common in public spaces in China?
Yes, definitely. It's riding transportation, in airports, in subway stations for security screenings, using your face to pay for consumer goods and retail settings. I don't think this is the case where it's become adopted without any qualms. Oftentimes, the myth is that Chinese people don't care about privacy, but I think Chinese people do care about privacy.
Jeffrey Ding from Oxford University. After 18 years defending the correct use of English, the Apostrophe Protection Society is admitting defeat. The society's founder says he has to accept that the English language is changing. Our correspondent Duncan Kennedy has more.
They linger above our letters. They wander around the endings of our words. But apostrophes, it seems, are an endangered species. The Apostrophe Protection Society, yes, there really is one, says their future is, well, up in the air. The Society's 96-year-old chairman, John Richards, says they're vital, yet people have struggles with these squiggles.
If you wrote a note saying, I've come to collect my brother's books, where you put the apostrophe, before or after the S, shows you exactly whether you have one brother or several brothers. Can't think of any way around that.
Mr. Richards has agonised over apostrophes for nearly two decades, but now says thanks to the likes of texting and Twitter, people have simply stopped using them.
I think it's a mixture of ignorance and laziness. They're too ignorant to know where it goes, they're too lazy to learn. So they just don't bother. The barbarians have won.
Mr. Richards says his society for this abused and misused punctuation mark is now closing, heralding what, for some, might be called an apostrophe catastrophe.
Duncan Kennedy. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
The entry requirements of Miss World are discriminatory. There is no place for them in the 21st century.
Why a former beauty queen is launching legal action against the Miss World competition. We are hurtling towards a point of no return, and humanity has to end its war on nature. Those are the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He's been speaking ahead of this week's climate conference in Madrid. He added that global efforts to meet emissions targets had been utterly inadequate, and he expected more from the world's biggest polluters.
What is still lacking is political will. Political will to put a price on carbon, political will to stop subsidies on fossil fuels, political will to stop building coal power plants from 2020 onwards, political will to shift taxation from income to carbon, taxing pollution instead of people. We simply have to stop digging and drilling and take advantage of the vast possibilities offered by renewable energy and nature-based solutions.
But Mr. Guterres did say there were some signs that a climate catastrophe could be averted.
We are in a deep hole, and we are still digging. Soon it will be too deep to escape. I welcome the voices of the young activists I've been meeting. They understand that we are jeopardizing their future. That is why I will continue to push every day to keep climate at the top of the international agenda.
This summit was supposed to have taken place in Chile, but political unrest in the South American nation meant it was moved to Madrid. The host, Spain's environment minister, Teresa Ribera, is tempering expectations. She doesn't think there'll be agreement on more ambitious targets.
I think that it could be fantastic, but I'm not sure governments are ready to take that, to commit to a concrete figure right now. But I think that what we need to hear is, yes, we have taken the message, we have heard that this is what we need, and we will do our best to be able to show concrete figures next year.
Our environment correspondent, Matt McGraw, is in Madrid, and he says a split has emerged between the world's biggest polluters and those that want urgent action on climate change.
The view, in some respects here, from the United States, who are leaving the Paris Agreement and have one more year to stay in before they can pull out, they have a team here on the ground. President Trump, you know, is coming to the Europe to deal with NATO. But here in Madrid, the head of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, will be here. So it's very clear that there's a kind of a very strong American split on what to do about climate change, and different politicians trying to come here to show their support for it. Other countries, obviously China, being a big factor in this process. They've been getting it in the neck recently for the number of coal-fired stations that are continuing to be operated in that country, and they seem to be doubling down on coal at the moment, much to the dismay of many others. So there are many big problems with the big polluters, as Mr. Guterres said, and it'll be interesting to see over the next 2 weeks if there's any movement from them, given how short of time the UN and many experts believe we are.
Matt McGraw. There's been another deadly gunfight between drug cartels and police in Mexico, this time in the state of Coahuila. At least 21 people were killed. So far this year, close to 30,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence. These latest deaths occur as President Andrés Manuel López Obrador marks 1 year in office, having pledged a less confrontational approach in tackling the cartels. Washington Post correspondent Mary Beth Sheridan told Julian Marshall what happened.
A group of gunmen from a cartel known as the Cartel of the Northeast swept into a town in Coahuila State. This is about 60 kilometers or so south of the U.S. border. They swept in yesterday. This was dozens of gunmen in at least 14 trucks. They attacked the municipal presidency, and that started a gunfight with local authorities that went on for well over an hour. And then the army arrived to reinforce the Mexican police and pursued these gunmen. The chase went on all night. And at the end of the operation, there were 17 gunmen killed and 4 police.
Yet another example, arguably, of how brazen the cartels have become in many parts of Mexico.
It's true. You know, you see really a tremendous disintegration of groups. This cartel was an offshoot of the Zetas, which was famously violent about a decade ago. But you see different groups all over the country fighting over whether it's drug trafficking routes, kidnapping, extortion, all sorts of different crimes that they've taken up. So really, you're looking at a very complex picture of violence.
So what's been President López Obrador's record in his first year in office in tackling the cartels?
You know, it's very interesting because he overall is very popular with approval ratings close to 70%. But the area where he's seen as most having failed is on security. You see the homicide rate is inching up. It's going to probably be a new record this year. Recently, there was a killing of several members of a U.S.-Mexican family. So there's really a sense that the president's strategies aren't making much progress.
Mary Beth Sheridan. Fish, a film by an Iranian artist, Abuzar Soltani, has just premiered at human rights film festivals in Bratislava and Budapest. What's unusual about it is that it was recorded in detention in Hungary on the Hungarian-Serbian border, where Abuzar and his 10-year-old son, Armin, have been stuck for almost a year. The father made the film to try to keep his son's spirits up. Nick Thorpe has this report.
A small boy paints a bright yellow sun on the glass of his window. Then he paints birds flying high, blue ocean waves, then finally fish, red fish, 5 in all. Then he pulls up the blind. Through the window we see shipping containers in an exercise yard surrounded by razor wire fence. Abuzar and Armin, father and son, have been in the transit zone with several hundred other asylum seekers since December 2018. I asked Abuzar in a written question why he made the film Fish about his son. He recorded his answer and sent it to me.
My son always drew his hopes and dreams and told me about them. When things got harder here, and when we were going to be deported to Iran, he stopped drawing and talking about them. I was witnessing the death of his dreams. So I had to keep his dreams alive, because my son is my hope and dream.
They entered Hungary legally after more than 2 years in Serbia, moving up the waiting list to get into the Hungarian transit zone. These are barbed wire encampments built into the border fence. The Hungarian government insists that this is not detention, but the UN Refugee Agency and human rights groups disagree. András Lederer of the Hungarian Helsinki Committee.
The Hungarian authorities try to deport this family back to Iran without ever assessing their asylum application on its merit. This practice empties out any asylum procedure and puts people's lives in danger.
Under a law which came into force in July 2018, the asylum claim of anyone who enters Hungary from Serbia can be dismissed as inadmissible. But Serbia refuses to accept them back. So those who are rejected are stuck in limbo, many in the pre-deportation section of the camp. Ernő Simon is the Hungary spokesman of the UN Refugee Agency.
As of today, there are over 350 asylum seekers detained in the two transit zones at the Hungarian-Serbian border. 194 of them are children. And among those children, almost 120 have been detained for more than half a year, and 34 of them have been in detention for over a year. This is absolutely unacceptable, inhuman, and even cruel.
The Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, explained his government's tough border controls in March this year at an international conference on migration.
We expend no energy on the issue of how to integrate migrants, because we don't need to integrate what we don't have. And all our efforts are focused on keeping things this way. We don't have to live together with large masses of people who are civilizationally different from the native population, and we want to preserve this situation.
Mr. Orbán says he's defending Christian Europe from an influx of Muslims. But one peculiarity of Abu Zar and his son's case is that they're both Christians. They converted on their journey through Bulgaria. We asked the National Directorate General for Aliens Policing, which runs the camp, for a comment, but they've not yet replied.
Nick Thorpe. Miss World, the longest-running international beauty pageant, comes to London in 2 weeks' time for its 69th competition, which will be broadcast globally to more than 150 countries. But now a Ukrainian model has launched legal action against the pageant. Veronika Didusenko was crowned Miss Ukraine 2018, but had her title taken away when organizers found out that she was a mother. Despite admitting she saw the rule on the application form, she's arguing that Miss World's entry policy is discriminatory. The BBC's Cherry Wilson told me more about Veronika Didusenko.
So she's a 24-year-old model who last year was crowned Miss Ukraine 2018. Now, those models or anyone who wins those goes on to compete in the International Miss World. But 4 days after she was crowned Miss Ukraine, she was stripped of her title because organisers found out that she was a mum. Now, she's got a little boy who's now five, and the rules of Miss World ban women from entering if they have children. It's a rule they've had in place for years.
So the rule's been in place for years, but now she's launched legal action. What is she hoping to achieve?
Well, she says that this rule is discriminatory and has no place in the 21st century. Now, her lawyers say that it's against the 2010 Equality Act. She hopes by taking this action, it will actually force Miss World to change what she says are outdated rules. She says being a mum doesn't affect her ability to do a job, and I spoke to her about this earlier.
I want rules of Miss World move with time and make them more fit for nowadays and to reflect women's reality today, who can perfectly balance between their career and personal life. Why should a woman be excluded from entering every pageant just because she is a mother? Being a mom doesn't have any implication on my ability to be professional or be a successful model. So those rules didn't make any sense to me.
Is Veronica the only woman to have experienced something like this?
No, she isn't. There was a woman who applied to take part in Miss England in 2014, and she had her application rejected because of the same reason. She was a mum.
Has anyone from the Miss World organisation responded?
Well, we've tried to contact Miss World, but they haven't got back to us yet. But in the past, its CEO said they have to take into account the feelings of countries across the world because this is a worldwide contest. So it's not just Europe taking part, it's other countries, and they've got to get that balancing act. And the director of Miss England, which is also part of the Miss World franchise, said in 2014 that it'd be unfair on children if they let their mums take part because they say that being Miss World is a really demanding job. It's a very grueling schedule. You have to go around all the world. And how do you balance that with having a child?
Cherry Wilson. One of the greatest classical conductors, Maurice Janssens, has died at his home in St. Petersburg, aged 76. He had long suffered from heart problems. A modest man, the Latvian had a stellar career leading orchestras such as the Oslo Philharmonic and the Amsterdam Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra. Maurice Janssens won popular and critical acclaim for his interpretations of Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, Mahler, and Shostakovich. Charles Haviland has this appreciation.
Dmitri Shostakovich, one of the composers Maurice Janssens became most identified with. Janssens was born in Nazi-occupied Riga, in hiding because his mother was Jewish. She was a singer and his father a conductor. And he later described how he grew up in opera houses because they didn't have babysitters. He studied violin at a top school but said that, being terribly lazy, he didn't get far. Janssens lived for more than half his life in the then Soviet Union. But moving within that country at the age of 13, from Latvia to Russia because of his father's work, changed his life forever. His career took shape in Leningrad. He said he always appreciated Soviet excellence in education and insistence on quality, though not the authorities' blocking of his early attempts to work in the West. Janssens did get a break working in Vienna, where he says the doorman humorously labelled him "that crazy Russian." When the Oslo Philharmonic offered him its top post, the Soviets turned a blind eye, letting him travel to and from Norway for a decade with no signed contract. In his 50s, Maurice Janssens collapsed and nearly died while conducting Puccini's La Bohème in Oslo. He lived 23 more years. An old family friend, Victor Lubermann, said of Janssens that anything he conducted was always a real event because he remained a creative artist rather than a conducting machine.
Charles Haviland and the conductor Maurice Janssens, who's died at the age of 76. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.